ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Three loud bangs ring out, and Adam Balzan wakes with a feeling of dread.
I woke up to the first three, went outside, went back in, got a breath, went out, and then another two shots went off. I knew it was gunshots then.
It's the tragic final moment of a police encounter gone wrong. Meters away, Adam's son Brad lies lifeless in his own backyard, in a cloud of OC spray. In this episode, we rewind around a minute before those gunshots, to the moment Brad bursts through the gate, police in tow. That minute is the only period of time since police encountered Brad that's not covered by CCTV. What happened in the final moments of Brad's life? This is episode 4 of Stop and Search, a special series by Background Briefing. I've come to the place where Brad's final moments played out. What happened in the backyard is the most crucial part of the police encounter. So what's emerged from the inquest is that Brad jumped over this back fence, followed by the officer. And there's only one way in and out, unless you want to go through the house, which is behind me. It's really cramped. It's a really tight space. Adam, Brad's father, is here with me today. Hey, Adam, how are you going?
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. So, I know it's difficult to be here at your house. Thanks for taking the time. Just talk me through where we are now.
About
here. This is the first time he's talked through what happened here since Brad died.
And somewhere just here, that's where they pulled the bullet out of the ground.
He's pointing out different spots in the backyard where Brad's final encounter with the police took place.
The shovel that he supposedly was going to swing was standing here.
Right.
Yeah. And they were over here fighting, so, yeah, I don't know how we could have reached to get that. This is where Brad was trying to get away from the OC spray. He had his back towards this gate here. After that, I come out of the back door and was suffering pretty bad from the spray and had to go back in.
I mean, this is tiny, this space as well. I mean, there's barely room for the two of us here. There are only two witnesses. The two officers who chased Brad down to his backyard. One of the officers, who you've heard referred to as Officer A, was excused from giving evidence at the coronial inquest on mental health grounds. A huge disappointment to Brad's family. But I've learned that that officer's version of events isn't totally lost. Because 5 days after Brad's death, that officer gave an interview to homicide detectives. And I've got the transcript.
The time is 1:25 p.m. This is a directed interview conducted at Mount Druitt Police Station on Saturday, the 26th of December, 2020.
We've asked actors to recreate the interview. This is taking place on Boxing Day at a police station a short drive away from where Brad died.
The interview reference number is R0675056.
It's important to say that because he was excused from giving evidence, Officer A's evidence was never tested at the inquest. In his interview, he's first asked about what happened in the last minute or so of his encounter with Brad. He says he remembers chasing Brad into the front gate of the house. On the CCTV footage, you can see Officer A bolting past and out of view. According to the officer, Brad then hopped onto a car bonnet, over a fence and into the backyard.
That's when I got close enough. And I yelled out. I was like, "Please stop." Like real pretty loud.
Brad ignores him and lands on the other side of the fence. Officer A loses sight of him. He helps his partner over the fence and then clambers over himself. On the other side, Officer A sees Brad again. He's now cornered.
He's stuck in a situation now. He's going to fight. And my understanding is he's either going to run or fight.
Officer A doesn't realise that it's actually Brad's house. He thinks he might try to break in.
So now I think, shit, he's trying to get into this house. I've got to get in there to stop him.
So Officer A pulls out his OC or capsicum spray.
To protect myself, protect Officer B.
And he fires it at Brad.
And it did nothing, absolutely nothing. He just punched through the spray.
The second officer, Officer B, also fires his spray. There's so much spray in the air, the officers are caught in the mist.
I was coughing and spluttering.
But he says Brad seems unaffected.
Didn't have no effect on him.
And out of the fog, Brad charges and tackles Officer B.
He sort of hit him and stayed low. So I went to the top half of the body to try and gain control. And we were wrestling and I was like, stop resisting.
All three are on the ground now.
He was strong. He was really, really strong. And I was trying to keep him down on the ground, keep my body weight on him to hold the top half of his arms so Officer B could get his arms underneath him to handcuff him.
Then Officer A feels a strange pain in his leg.
I started feeling pinches.
It's Brad's dog, Nala, biting his calf.
I'd describe it as pig rooting, trying to pull me backwards.
He loses his grip on Brad.
I kicked out at the dog.
Then focuses back on Brad again, who's now on his knees.
And he's picked up a shovel and gone to hit Officer B.
So he launches himself at Brad again.
Just jumped at him, hit him over the top. The shovel hit the ground, we both went down head first. My head's hit the ground, his head's hit the ground.
And then he spots something.
I look over his shoulder and I see a gun on the ground. And I've yelled out, gun, fuck, gun.
Officer A doesn't explain how exactly the gun came to be on the ground, but he recalls Brad somehow managing to grab it.
So I'm fighting with him. He's swinging his arms. I'm trying to hold his arms down away from my legs.
The two keep fighting as the officer wrestles for control of the weapon.
To keep the gun face towards the ground, away from myself and away from Officer B.
Then gunshots. Officer A says Brad fires the gun.
He starts shooting. Just bang, bang. And like it was two, three quick shots. But on the third shot, for some reason, we fell to the ground.
Then he sees the barrel of the gun.
And it's in his hands.
So he grabs hold of the muzzle and the slide.
So I'm fighting, pretty much for my life.
He says Brad begins turning the gun towards him.
But I'm forcing with my right hand the barrel away from my face and my body, and at the same time I'm trying to fight with his hands to get my gun back.
Now Officer A says Brad's finger is on the trigger.
And I can feel his fingers pulling the trigger, so I'm fighting with his fingers.
But the gun's still turning.
Towards me again. And then I yelled out, like, he's going to shoot, you know. He's trying to shoot me.
Then two gunshots.
Bang, bang.
Brad goes weak and falls backward. Officer B has just shot him. This account seems straightforward. But as the inquest gets underway, key differences emerge between this version of events and what Officer B witnessed. Did Brad really threaten a police officer with a shovel before firing wildly and then trying to shoot Officer A with his own gun? At the inquest, Officer B is giving his version of the events. And again, this is a recreation of his account.
Could you state your occupation?
Yes, so Senior Constable at the Nepean Police Area Command.
During the inquest, he's asked about those first moments in the backyard when both officers jumped the fence and pulled out their OC spray. And here's the first of a number of discrepancies in the two police officers' accounts. While Officer A says the spray had no effect on Brad, Officer B remembers Brad rubbing his face. And that's important because when Brad charged, he may have just been trying to get away from the spray. Officer B is asked whether this occurred to him on the day, that Brad might be simply running in a disorientated fashion to get away from the OC spray.
At the time, that didn't occur to me, no.
Could it have been an act of self-preservation?
I don't agree with that, no.
He's also asked why he didn't try and talk to Brad first, instead of spraying him. He tells the inquest that he felt
violent resistance or confrontation was likely to occur.
A lawyer seizes on this response, and in particular, the specific phrase Officer B is using.
Where do you get that phrase from?
Oh, it is from the justifications for use of OC spray.
Is that what was actually in your mind, or is that something you have come up with later on?
No, that was in my mind.
Really?
Yes.
In a moment of self-reflection during his testimony, Officer B says if he had known it was actually Brad's house, he may not have used the OC spray.
I probably could have spoken to him, but at that time, in my mind, spraying was the best option available to me.
And here's another discrepancy. According to Officer A's account, Brad was about to hit Officer B with a shovel. But did Officer B see Brad holding a shovel?
No, I didn't. I do remember seeing a shovel on the ground, but I never saw him, the shovel in his hand.
A shovel was found in the backyard, but DNA testing produced no identifying results and no fingerprints. The only other evidence that Brad was holding a shovel is secondhand. A female officer who came into the backyard after the shooting remembers being told about it by Officer A. And now we get to probably the most important and most difficult question to answer. What about the gun? How did it come out of the holster? The inquest heard police holsters are designed so that guns can't just fall out or be easily removed. So what happened? Officer A had said in his interview he saw his own gun on the ground and Brad grabbed for it.
It was just laying there on its own, laying flat, facing the backyard.
Officer B says he didn't see the gun on the ground. And then there's another discrepancy in the accounts over the gun. A female officer told the inquest she remembered a conversation she'd had with Officer A about the gun on the day of Brad's death. She said that Officer A told her Brad
grabbed my gun and got it out of the holster.
So did Brad pull it out? Or did it just fall out? Or did something else happen? Officer B also says during the scuffle, he couldn't see how Brad got the gun.
All I could see was the back of Bradley.
But when he hears and recognises the gunshots, he pulls out his firearm and notices
Bradley had his right hand on the grip and his finger, index finger, on the trigger of the firearm.
But when he's pressed on this, he seems less certain about what he saw. Was Brad holding it with two hands or one?
I don't know if he had two, yes.
So with these differing accounts, is there any other evidence that could help us? Well, the holster was tested by firearms experts and they couldn't work out how the gun had fallen out. No faults were found with the locking mechanism and there was no evidence that Brad had any experience handling firearms or removing a gun from a holster. No fingerprints suitable for collection were found on either the holster or the firearm. And while testing on the gun found some traces of Brad's DNA, the inquest heard there were also innocent reasons why that might be the case, and no conclusions could be drawn from it. It's worth just mentioning at this point that a weapons expert gave evidence at the inquest that both officers acted consistently with New South Wales Police firearm and OC spray policies. He said,
"Control is our objective, not de-escalation. The ultimate objective is control."
There is one other alternative theory about what happened in that backyard, and it comes from Brad's father, Adam, in his statement to police. It has to do with Brad's dog, Nala, the one who attacked Officer A. Adam said Brad loved Nala and would have wanted to protect her. He believed Officer A pulled out the gun himself and attempted to shoot the dog. Then there was a scuffle and two more shots went off accidentally. So, according to Adam's theory, it was Officer A who fired the first shot before Brad grabbed the gun to try and stop him. Officer B is questioned about this by Adam's lawyer. Could Officer A have pulled out his own gun while the dog was biting him?
I do not believe so, no. I do not know how his gun got out of his holster.
And there's another mystery, also relating to a piece of police equipment. On the morning of Brad's death, Officer B checked out one of the body-worn cameras for use that day. But at the time Brad was wrestling with police in the backyard, the camera was sitting on the dashboard of their unmarked police car, just around the corner. So why didn't Officer B put it on?
The actual reason why I didn't, I can't say for sure.
He says it was his normal practice to use it, but for a reason he can't remember, he just didn't. He's then asked about another possible motive for leaving his body cam behind. And that has to do with a case we talked about in the previous episode, Ebony Madden. That case was dismissed and cost the police force more than $300,000 after a court found different officers from the same unit had made an unlawful search and arrest. The body-worn camera was a key piece of evidence then. So, was Officer B's decision to leave the body cam behind on the day of Brad's death in any way linked to Ebony Madden's acquittal? No, says Officer B. It had nothing to do with that. So I'm just driving out to the final days of the inquest into Brad Balzin's death. I was speaking with Adam Balzin about it earlier in the week, and, you know, he's anxious about it, but I think he's hoping that he'll get some more answers to what happened to Brad. Hey, Adam. How you going?
Not too bad, Paul. Yourself?
Yeah, good, thanks.
That's good.
A lot has happened since I last spoke to Adam. Brad Balzin's story has now been read, watched, or listened to by more than 2 million people, and I've been inundated with emails and messages, some even from former police. It's been an extraordinary response, and it's a lot for Adam, but he feels like Brad is finally being heard.
It feels good to actually have a voice for him. He's got his own voice at the moment. It's been good.
And what do you kind of hope is going to come out of these next few days?
Hopefully we get some kind of justice for him.
But not all responses have been positive. Outside the hearing room, there are police officers everywhere. I introduce myself to a group of them. One of them says, no comment, not until it's reported correctly. I ask him what he means, but he's already walking away. There are also around 20 of Brad's family and friends. When we walk into the hearing room, they sit on the far left, and roughly the same number of police officers sit on the far right. The coroner enters and greets the family informally. It's like she's inviting them into her home. Police witnesses take the stand and are questioned about training. What emerges is that in the academy, police are taught nothing specifically about how to do proactive policing, only about search powers generally. The lawyer acting for the officers that chased Brad tenders a bundle of documents. They're images of people wearing hoodies in training material. It's not specifically about the kind of scenario with Brad. These people are actually actors employed by the police. They've been asked to wear hoodies. I'm not quite sure what the purpose of it is, and the coroner seems troubled by it.
It seems there is a very heavy emphasis on the wearing of a hoodie, and that may be a very dangerous thing for police to be trained in.
As the hearing draws to a close, Brad's family is invited to make their own statements. Adam is too distraught, so it's read by his sister-in-law, Jacqueline. It describes how Brad was humble and loving, and how this tragedy has shattered their family. They'll never feel safe around the police again. Brad's mum, Belinda, reads her own statement. She says Brad was her best friend, a young man full of compassion and love, and she could see the person he was growing into. Belinda says the 20 years of his life were the best years of hers. While these statements are being read out, all of the police officers in the room are watching on. I've never seen the room so still. I approach the family after the hearing, but they're just too upset to talk. Then, at the last moment, Brad's uncle Troy drives up to the cameras at the entrance.
Our families will never be the same. We can't catch up. We don't make them phone calls. It's ruined two entire families. I believe that there should be a royal commission, and that's all I've got to say.
Brad's family will have to wait a little longer before the inquest draws to a close. The coroner will consider all the evidence she's heard and make findings. Maybe she'll form a view of what exactly happened in the backyard, but maybe not. Maybe the system of proactive policing will come under fire, but it might not. For Brad's father, the end of the inquest is not quite the end of the story. He's now brought a civil claim against the state of New South Wales. Adam's lawyer, Peter O'Brien, says it goes right to the heart of the issues around proactive policing.
The case that we are litigating is the worst possible outcome imaginable of proactive policing gone wrong, where police think they have the power when they do not, we allege, to stop, to search.
The state of New South Wales is yet to file a defence to the claim. When I leave Brad's family after the final day of hearings, I think back on what brought me here. When I first heard about this story, I made a lot of assumptions. A 20-year-old acting suspiciously in a bad neighbourhood. Maybe he was involved in drugs, maybe he was violent. But what comes out of the inquest is a much more complicated picture. It's revealed how the police themselves make assumptions. How a black hoodie can set off a chain of events that end in tragedy. I wonder how many other people there are walking around in black hoodies on warm days, just going about their business. In the 3 years since Brad's death, his family have found small ways to honour and remember him. Belinda had this idea for Brad's birthdays when he was growing up. Instead of flashy gifts, she'd give him experiences.
I was going to do the skydive when he was 21, but I wanted to do it with him. And that's just what I was going to do when he turned 21.
Brad didn't get to do that jump. He never made it to his 21st birthday. But after his death, Belinda decided to do the jump anyway. She'd already bought the tickets.
I was talking to my mum about it and my brother. And Brian said, why don't we just ask and see who wants to do it as well? Just to sort of do it as like a remembrance sort of thing.
In the end, they all jumped. Adam, Belinda, Troy, Nicole, and a few cousins. Around 30 friends and family came out for the occasion. Even Nola Bowson, Brad's grandmother, after she got the okay from a cardiologist.
Jumping out of the plane at 68, I thought, oh my goodness, but that's what he was going to do for his 21st birthday. So we all went and did it, friends and friends of friends, and it was really, really a beautiful moment to be doing that with him.
On the day of the skydive, the whole group wore jumpers with the words, "Jump for Brad" on the front. And they landed on a beach, because Brad loved the beach.
That was good. Really good. Can I stop for a second?
For the Bowsons, it was a way to start letting go. To remember their son, not in that hoodie, not lying in the backyard, but just as he was.
It just felt, I don't know, kind of being close to Brad. And just the free falling, it's almost like he was there. It's nice, but It still would have been nicer to do it with him.
Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering and theme composition by Russell Stapleton. Fact-checking by Benjamin Sveen. Our supervising producer is Mario Christodoulou. The executive producer is Fanu Falali. And I'm Paul Farrell. You can subscribe to Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app. Thanks for listening.